You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 29th of July 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's programme.
Africa is on the move. Africa is one of the fastest growing regions of the world. People are being lifted out of poverty. Incomes are up. The middle class is growing.
It's a wrap. US President Barack Obama has finished his African tour with skyrocketing reviews. But what lessons are there to be learned? My guests, Kathleen Burke and Martin Plaut, will assess this and the day's other top stories, including...
The operation against IS is for show. Under the impression of battling IS, Kurdish forces are being targeted.
As the country's Kurdish People's Democratic Party condemns Turkey's strikes on the PKK, we examine what's behind the planned safe zones in Syria. Then we turn our focus to Afghanistan and examine the impact of the death of the leader of the Taliban, Mullah Omar. All that, plus a look at the release of the Israeli spy, Jonathan Pollard. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, right here on Monocle 24. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Kathleen Burke and Martin Plaut. Kathleen Burke is Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London. And Martin Plaut is a Fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies. And welcome both back to the programme again. Well, we're going to start today in Africa. US President Barack Obama has just wrapped up his Africa tour, a trip marked by harsh remarks on human rights and democracy, the signing of a few trade agreements, and even a dance-off in Kenya. But while some argue this trip was long overdue, others say that there could have been a better time for it. Martin, how do you judge this tour? As we were saying at the top of in the introduction to the programme today, it's had some very good feedback, and he seems to have gone down, even while saying some rather critical things.
Yeah, I mean, I think this was a barnstorming performance. I mean, he was just stunning. This was a man relaxed, at home, happy in himself. He walked into the wonderful Chinese-built building, the African Union headquarters, and goes into the hall, and the place erupts. And every time he talked, he was cheered to the rafters. I think this was an extraordinarily good speech that he gave, and a very, very good tour. I mean, he really has made his mark, and I think Africa forgives him for not coming before.
And just tell me, before I bring in Kathy, that audience at the African Union is, it's heads of states, it's government officials from all of those countries around the region. As you said...
Mr. Mugabe was not invited.
Okay.
And he's the chairman of the African Union, so it was quite a snub.
But a good diversity of people in that room.
Yeah.
Why are they invested now in Obama? Whereas you say there has been criticism of his policy in Africa, it's felt that America has been lagging behind China. Why do you think that those people in the room were on his side?
Because he speaks their language. He just makes it clear that he's one of them. He's, of course, an American. And he made it very clear. He said, look, I'm a proud American, but I'm also an African. And that is who he is, and that is... They just love it. They just lap it up.
Kathleen, we've talked about lessons to be learned. It's great that you come in and you put on a great show and everyone's impressed while you're in town. But lessons to be learned. He talked today about the fact that, for example, presidents need to give up power. He made a joke about he could quite easily get elected a third time. But actually, even while he still has ideas about what America should do, you have to leave the stage at certain points. What lessons do you think there are to be learned or that will be learned after he's left Africa?
Depends. Lessons by whom? Lessons by the leaders. Possibly don't invite Barack Obama back whilst they're still in power. Lessons for younger people. They may well remember how he came from almost nothing to become president by mobilization on social media. He's black. They're black. I mean, it's a quintessential avatar. That if he can do it, they can do it. At least they don't have the racism to overcome. Yes, I can. Yes, we can. His slogan is something that must appeal. One gathers, I was reading a lot of the material as Martin was, and he seems to have been an inspiration to the younger people, and of course the younger people are well over 50% of, in fact, 65% now of the population, so that if he can get them, well, who cares about the 78 to 80-year-olds? They're not going to be around that long, but these kids are going to be. He inspired them, and they can do in many respects what he can do in terms of mobilization.
Martin, it was fascinating. I think at home in the US, he's used his heritage, his race in a much more ambitious way of late. You know, he's kind of in these terrible kind of racial incidents. You know, he's really kind of spoken for America. And here, it was great to see him arrive in Kenya. And he was, you know, in the past, perhaps there was a suspicion that, you know, he'd been told to keep quiet a little bit about, you know, the his middle name and all his kind of heritage. But he was, you know, he was going home as an African. He kind of really made the most of it. Yeah, do you think that's just an emotional response, or do you think that someone said to him, you know, this is the way to kind of beat China because you have that heritage, you have that direct link, let's make the most of it?
Absolutely. And I mean, you know, China is the big competitor on the African continent. And, you know, he did make some quite hard remarks about China as if they were just sort of coming in there to take what they wanted and would leave, while as the United States has a much longer term relationship. And I think one should not underestimate the serious business that has probably been done here. Now, I think a lot of it will have been secret, particularly in Kenya is involved in a terrible war with al-Shabaab in Somalia. The Ethiopians have drone bases in Ethiopia, you know, from which they attack various groups. There's a lot of intelligence work that goes on. This was a serious visit as well. And, you know, there were also some tough messages. There's a great quote from my former colleague, Karen Allen of the BBC, when she said that when the Ethiopian leadership, who frankly have put their political opponents in jail, Obama says, you know, opponents should not be branded as terrorists and critical journalists should not be jailed. She says, my taxi driver sat up and listened, and so would millions of others, no doubt. And I think she was right.
Kathleen, I think one of the other great things about it is that, you know, he's quite good at kind of changing mindsets, key points. And his vision of Africa was one of, this was a visit of meeting equals. This was about meeting, you know, countries which were full of entrepreneurs, full of potential. They weren't just the recipients of aid. In fact, far from it. They were countries which could be exporting wealth and that Africa needed to be doing business with America. Do you think that he has that ability to affect that kind of change in the country, or well, in the continent rather?
I don't see why not. I mean, he's clearly says the sorts of things that their own leaders aren't saying. He has the global outlook. He's from the United States, which is still the star of the show and that sort of thing. If he says, "Look, you can do it. Look, we're waiting for it. Look, you can do just like we did," of course it's going to make a difference. Money is a problem, but entrepreneurs are growing very rapidly. I mean, think of Nigeria, for example, which is really becoming a powerhouse, if only it can worry about, you know, sort out Boko Haram and so forth. So I think what he did, I agree with everything that Martin said. I'm sure there was work on intelligence and defense and security going on at the same time. I'm sure saying that countries that come in, build infrastructure with expatriate labor and extract minerals. People know who he was talking about, and he was making the implicit comparison, although that's a bit of a weak comparison, if I may say so. But I think it was a triumphant visit, and unusually for these sorts of things, and also for President Obama, it seems not to have caused any storms in the States, in fact. So unusually, this is a foreign trip that seems to have come out trumps everywhere.
Martin, before we move on, you know, I guess the only other story that could have knocked him off the front page was oddly an Africa story this week, Cecil the Lion in Zimbabwe. So that kept Mr. Mugabe busy, perhaps. That's the reason he couldn't attend. But we should just kind of lay out the landscape a little bit, because, you know, people listening in will want us not to get too carried away with saying, oh, everything's sunny and rosy, new relationship, you know, Africa sorting out its house on its own. There still remains, you know, the corruption, countries like Angola, there still remains, you know, despots. We only have to go to Sudan. Do you think he, you know, we've said he made some good criticisms, but do you think he was strong enough as well at pointing out the problems?
Well, I mean, you know, he could have been stronger, perhaps, you know, saying to the Ethiopians that they just rigged the election. I mean, you know, they just got 100% of the seats. every single seat in the parliament. Now, nobody believes it was true. And, you know, he didn't really bring that up as far as we can see, certainly not in public with the Ethiopians. He didn't say very much, although he did warn the South Sudanese that if they weren't careful, there would be sanctions against them. So there were some tough messages in there. But, you know, there are 54 countries. How many can he run through? You know, it's a very, very hard ask. And, you know, I don't often say this, but honestly, I do think that he deserves a tick next to his name for this one.
Yeah, there seems to be that kind of excitement around him again that was in the early days of Obama. It's a different president.
What the really good walk he walked was a thin line between gesture politics and making a difference. I mean, there's no point saying, look, you president of the country in which I am, you are really a rotten person. This is really going to make a difference, isn't it? It may not play back home so well, but I think you have to run a line. You can't spit in your host's house too much.
Now, like Mr. Obama, it's time for us to leave Africa. But we're heading to Turkey, not to Washington, D.C. As heavy strikes against the PKK continue, President Erdogan now says that peace with the Kurds is impossible. This abruptly renews focus on the Kurds, has raised questions over Ankara's true intentions, with the leader of the pro-Kurdish party claiming that Turkey's war on terror is a cover to stop Kurds from forming their own territory. Kathleen, do you think that's a fair assessment of what's going on?
Oh, I'm sure it's part of it. I mean, the Turks and the Kurds inside Turkey have been fighting for well over 20 years. And it's just sad that the peace, the sort of fragile peace that's been going on for the past 2 years has now been crushed with a sledgehammer. The thing is that if you look at a map and you can see the south border of Turkey is the northern border of Syria, and it's also the southeastern is the border with Iraq. And if you've got on the border between Turkey and Iraq, the Kurdistan regional area now, and you've got the same sort of thing coming from the other direction, what Turkey is terrified of is those two areas meet, because the third area, of course, is southern Turkey. So from Erdogan's point of view, I can see it's not difficult to see why they're apprehensive. But the idea that the Allies are going to wear for long, four planes going against ISIS and 40 planes going against the Kurds in northern Iraq, somehow the balance doesn't seem to be there. So yes, he is. And yes, will it work? I don't know. It partly depends on what the Americans do.
Martin, there's some really kind of grubby, dark politics that goes on around Syria, and this seems to have a whiff of it. You know, Turkey in the end has got what it wanted. It wanted this safe zone, which certainly does divide up the Kurdish area. In return, America is allowed to fly planes from Incirlik to do bombing raids into Syria, and that's the kind of the backroom deal. It feels almost for the Kurds. Is this really bad news, or do you think that actually the Americans are a little bit more confident that this isn't going to... Because we're so dependent on the Kurdish people in so many of these instances for trying to take back Kobani, to try and do the dirty work. Have they been sold short?
Well, I mean, of course, we shouldn't forget that the Kurds have been sold short for many, many years. I mean, you know, they've never had the state that they always hoped that they would get. And that is their great problem, is where is their homeland? And the difficulty is that they've had to make deals with everybody in the region. And even within the Turkish perspective, there are three different groups, some of whom they have good relations with, some of which they wish to wipe out, and some of which they have just bad relations with. So it's an extremely complex picture. And, you know, the difficulty is, how are they going to get from where they are now, which is, after all, quite a long way better than it used to be? Don't forget that Turkey used to describe the Kurds as mountain Turks. They denied their existence. It was illegal to call them Kurds. So they have moved quite a long way. They have opened talks with the Kurds, which have been going on. Are they off? Well, let's see where that goes. So, you know, there has been a movement, but it is clearly a step back. But part of the reason that is because the Kurds actually won quite a lot of seats in the Turkish parliament. And now he wants to find a way of pushing back against this. And this is at least part of the answer, I think.
But what's intriguing is, you know, as you say, first of all, that the election incident is interesting because they made this terrible threshold. You had to get 10% before you could have an MP, and then
they got it.
Yeah, then they got it.
They got 13.
This is, on another hand, this seems another way of, Erdogan kind of taking that back, saying, okay, you're the enemy, and it would be bad for, you know, Turkish people. Because many moderate Turkish people voted for the Kurdish party because they said they'd stand up for everything from, like, women's rights to, you know, to gay rights as well in Turkey, which is unheard of. So it's a way of him conquering them. But it's also just miserable when you look at the fight and the number of Kurdish people lost taking back Kobani, for example. And now that's going to be within a safe zone, taken over by the Turks, who kind of, yeah, as far as Western observers were concerned, kind of sat back and watched what was happening there. Kathleen, you know, when we look at all what's going on there, what do you feel that the Turks kind of want? You know, do they want to take on ISIS? Do they really want, in the end, a peace deal with the Kurds? Do they want, you know, a fully fledged democracy? What's your inkling about the thinking that's going on in Ankara?
Well, it depends who you're talking to and about, of course. It's been quite clear ever since before he came to power that Erdogan wants an Islamic State. But Islamic State does not mean an ISIS. It's clear that he thinks that if you have Islamic law, that means there are certain things you do and certain things you don't do. He fears this is being challenged by a free media and so forth, so you have to be careful about that. He's testing the waters, I think, to see how far he can go. And I agree with Martin entirely. The mobilization against the home Kurds, might say, is a way of building a nationalist response for an election that most people think he's going to call in the autumn. Turkey wants to be the great regional power. That's been clear ever since Atatürk's time after 1919. And in many respects, she ought to be. She's got the power, she's got the size, she's got the wealth, she's got centuries and millennia of experience. But that means that she also feels, and she has the power to make sure she's got cordon sanitaire around her. She doesn't want enemies on her borders. And the enemies on her borders are more Kurds now than ISIS. And so as long as that's the case, I think, what country wants to go throw its people into the chance of being beheaded if it's not necessary? If Turkey's allies will take that task on, they can concentrate on the Kurds.
Well, we're going to leave that subject there for the moment because we're going to take a short break. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, and my guests are Kathleen Burke and Martin Plaut. Coming up next, reports of Mullah Omar's death. Does it actually matter? And is spy Jonathan Pollard's release just a way to tame Benjamin Netanyahu? Stay tuned.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In New York, our bureau chief is Ed Stocker.
I think our team very much knows and is tapped into what's happening in the city. We're looking at those websites, we're looking at those news channels that give us perhaps stories that go beyond the big headlines and tap into the sort of thing that we want to cover on Monocle 24 and in the magazine as well.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are my guests today, Kathleen Burke and Martin Plaut. Now, the Afghan government has confirmed new reports that Mullah Omar, the Taliban leader, is dead. The Taliban are yet to confirm or deny the claims following a week of speculation over the whereabouts of the insurgent leader. And it does seem that he actually may have died 2 years ago, Martin. And the simple question, does it matter, really?
It's hard to know. I mean, in a sense, one sort of feels, Taliban? We haven't heard from them for a while, have we? I mean, it's sort of been so much ISIS. And I suppose that is their problem. They seem to be, I wouldn't say a spent force by any means, but they seem to be a lesser force at the moment. And so perhaps the death of their leader is indicative of this, you know, that they've lost a central mind in the system, and they are not as effective as they used to be. So perhaps it does matter, but we've only just discovered it.
Kathleen, you know, as we said, you know, ISIS, you know, now this, you know, forming, you know, running parts of Syria, running parts of Iraq. This was the Taliban's dream to run Afghanistan, but since they were kind of deposed, they haven't really been much of a force because they were so kind of, I guess, Pakistan and Afghanistan was their terrain. But, you know, we now have ISIS, which, you know, has kind of global aspirations. Do you feel they seem, you know, a bit of a minor worry on the cards of the world's leaders.
I mean, it's funny, isn't it? I mean, one outcome of thinking, well, Omar is dead or that he hasn't been doing anything is at least four commanders of Taliban have peeled off and declared for ISIS, in fact. So the Taliban seems to be slightly fragmenting inside. On the other hand, Taliban is mostly Pashtun, and Pashtuns were the leaders, the rulers in Afghanistan for 300 years. So I think on the whole, this might not be, the ISIS will probably come and go, but unless they exterminate them, Pashtun and are going to be there. It's important because these sorts of groups need a symbol. Mullah Omar was the symbol, even if he hadn't fought since 1996. So the fact that somehow now all of a sudden it's emerged that he's not there, it does make me wonder, if he's not been there for 2 years, what has happened lately to trigger this off? And if he has been there for 2 years, and in fact he has just died, why haven't the Taliban confirmed it?
It seems to have come out in talks between Pakistan and the Taliban that it was kind of mentioned, kind of quietly confirmed then by, you know, supposedly foreign forces. We're not exactly sure how he died. There's some suggestion he died even in a hospital in Karachi. Masimo, is there some kind of notion of hope here, though, I wonder, when you think, you know, that when you look at, you know, we were so scared of the Taliban, and we were so kind of fearful what would happen. Osama bin Laden was the most wanted man in the world. It does feel like an age ago that almost we're looking at ISIS and its current lineup of leaders and its current control of territory, that actually these terrible forces of terrorism and brutality can come and go rather quickly in their kind of dominance.
Well, that's certainly true. I have something of an insight into Mullah Omar, which I must admit I never thought I would get. Many years ago, I was actually in Pakistan, and we went as far as we could up towards the Afghan border, and we came across a madrasa there. And we went in, they were very polite to us, and we said to them, well, could we just come and talk to you? And they said, yes, sure, come in. And we discussed all sorts of things. They were very hospitable, they gave us lunch. And then we said, you know, what do you know about the Taliban? He said, oh, well, you know, they used to all come here. This is where we educated them. And in fact, we had Mullah Omar here. But he has no right to call himself a mullah. And they said, he never passed his final exam, so he is not a mullah. And they were most insistent upon this. They're very nice people. But, you know, clearly they had their own views on things. I mean, for example, they said that, you know, that the you know, the attack on the Twin Towers was certainly planned by the Israelis, and we knew that immediately. I mean, this is a kind of, you know, conspiracy thing. But I mean, they said these were educated people coming out with this. It's the sort of thing you get all over the Islamic world.
Catherine, again, just looking at that notion of taking out the strong man, we see a lot of the kind of US drone attacks seem to be targeted against, you know, key individuals, whether, you know, in Afghanistan, in Syria, in Iraq. The idea that, you know, if you take out one or two people, that it will kind of change the landscape. Perhaps with, you know, Osama bin Laden, it did in a way, even though he wasn't so powerful, and we know now that he was kind of sitting in his room fretting over, were people listening to him anymore? But in a way, I guess he was an icon for many people. But it doesn't seem to really affect these organizations, you know, ISIS and things. They seem to be so cell-like that they kind of bounce back. The same for the Taliban, the hardcore. It's unlikely that, you know, we believe in the strongman politics, but it seems unlikely to really be the death knell for any of these groups.
Well, when you have a society and an organization that's fundamentally tribalist, if you knock out one leader of a tribe, there are other tribes and there are other leaders who can rapidly fill. I mean, if you knock out a bomb maker, that is probably more changing because it takes a while to train up another one. But if you're used to not having a unified state or a unified organization, if it's fundamentally a tribal society, you'd have to take out an awful lot of heads of tribes to be able to actually change leadership aspirations, I think. So it depends on who you're knocking out one by one.
Well, finally on today's show, and I've been asked by my guests to make sure we have plenty of time to talk about this. This shows the true insight into their kind of beliefs and aspirations. We're going to talk about Disneyland Paris, which is under investigation for apparently overcharging foreigners. The European Commission has prompted France to start looking into the prices at the theme park after receiving a series of complaints of overcharging based on where people live. Now, I think some of the people have been overcharged have supposedly been British and German tourists who have been particularly singled out in these reports. So apparently French visitors get to pay £950 or the equivalent of for a premium package, while British visitors are paying £1,320 and those very wealthy Germans are paying £1,727. Now, Martin, I think you're a Disney fan or you were keen to get on this topic. What's your view of Mr. Mickey Mouse's dealings?
Well, I'm right behind Mickey Mouse. Not that I have ever been. Let me be honest about this.
I thought I saw you peeping around the corner.
But I am absolutely behind Mr. Mouse because, you know, all that is happening here is the basic logic of economics, which is price discrimination. Anyone who's ever done any economics knows about price discrimination. You charge the market with what it bears. So, for example, I now am lucky enough to carry a pensioner's pass. I get a reduced rate into a cinema. And I would defy anybody here, in fact, any of you, to say that you wouldn't take a cheap seat if you could. Now, why did they give it to me? Because I can afford less. Well, at least they think I can. So, and the same.
I was going to say, I'll have a word. I don't think our fees are that bad.
So, the same is true with the Germans, the French. All the Disney is doing is standard issue economics. They're just charging the market what it'll bear.
Can I add something there, in fact, which is quite interesting? If the Germans got charged 80% more and the British 40% more, we have a new economic index in the making, don't we?
Absolutely.
The Disney index. That depend on how rich you as a country are, that's, on that depends your discount, in which case that's probably just as good as anything else.
Absolutely.
Well, I think there's another magazine, it's called The Economist or something. They have a little chart which they run every now and then. It's like an index, which is the hamburger index. It's
That's
what people
right.
are charged. Yeah. So although it's not within the same nation what different people are charged, they look at the fact that, you know, what you pay for a hamburger is not the same if you go downtown in Athens, if you go downtown in Amsterdam. There are different prices. Again, it's all supposedly within
the same is true.
Euro.
You go to India and buy a premium quality razor blade and see what you charge. And you go to New York and see what you charge. They're completely different prices for these things. People put out the market what it will bear. I don't care. If people don't want to go to Disney, don't go. Guess what? The price will fall.
I've also noticed, actually, when you travel to some kind of, Egypt is a good example. If you go to a museum in Cairo, they have a local rate for, if you're Cairene, you'll pay the equivalent like 10 pence. And if you're from the West, you'll pay the equivalent of £10. So they think actually overseas people, you can cough up a bit more. And I think actually here in the UK, there's been a bit of discussion lately that actually the cuts, the austerity mean that lots of local museums are going to have to start charging for entry.
They've already started.
Yeah, and I think that there the discussion is, you know, do we let people who can prove they're locals come in for free, but start charging those kind of, you know, pesky foreigners who are coming to our towns. Do you think that's fair enough, Catherine, to kind of charge overseas people going to our museums more or people coming from overseas more?
Well, what's wholly unusual in Britain is that they don't cost anything yet. Any overseas person coming and be charged £2 is going to think they have a deal anyhow. I will be sorry to see museums charge for anyone, but particularly for local. I mean, what would you have to do? Would you have to flash your passport to show that you do sort of justify what cost you were going to get? People might think, well, people on the one hand would think it's unfair. On the other hand, people would think, right, let's get what we can out of the foreigners.
Well, it happens with every taxi, I think, in every country outside of Europe. You'll certainly be kind of ranked on how much you charge. But on that question of cultural institutions around the world, do you think they have the right to charge wealthier visitors from, you know, developed countries and, you know, let people who live locally pay less?
I think it's a fairly standard way of doing things. It doesn't bother me in the slightest. I must say, it is always surprising. I always forget that one has to pay for a museum when I go to Berlin or Paris. I'm always rather shocked by how much I have to pay. It sort of comes as a surprise that you have to go into these things. I don't mind. It's fine. You know, one can, after all, you've paid a lot of money to get there anyway. Who cares about a few bob? And, you know, the museums certainly need it. So I'm not opposed to it. I'm in favour of Mr. Mouse and his associates.
Unless they're so young and poor that they wouldn't go in otherwise.
True.
That's okay. Where I draw the line.
Final quick reveal. We've only got a few seconds. Have you been to Disney?
I told you I haven't.
Okay, and Catherine?
Good God, no.
What about you?
I've never been to Disney. I've been to Universal Studios once. which was, which was
just
good.
About
I've been,
it.
I've been on the Back to the Future ride. I must be the only adult who screamed when you look over the edge of the car, you realise you're not going anywhere. So it was a bit of a misplaced scream as well. But anyway, that's my story. And that's all I'm very glad to say we have time for on today's Midori House. The show was produced by Carlotta Ribello. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Paige Reynolds, and also Eugenia Elenaskaya. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, Josh Fenner will be here bringing you music from Monocle's international playlist. Then the 1900 Hours is The Entrepreneurs. But from me, Andrew Tuck, it's just time to say thank you very much for listening and goodbye.